Hi, this is Perry. I just wanted to cut in and apologize for the sound quality of today's show. We had a little audio issue and we don't have the best recording, but I think there was some good stuff in here, and so we're just gonna go with it. I hope you enjoy this one.
Hi, I'm Perry, and you're listening to The Beauty Brains. Hello and welcome to The Beauty Brains, a show where real cosmetic chemists answer your beauty product questions and give you a unique look at the cosmetic industry. This is episode 241. I'm your host, Perry Romanowski, and with me today is Valerie George. Hello, Valerie.
Hi, Perry.
How are you holding up on this election day?
I'm doing okay. I haven't had a chance to look at anything. I'm just here working away. So
yeah, me
we'll
either.
See how it goes tonight.
No, me either. And let's make this a no election free zone, or it's an election free zone. Whatever happens tomorrow just happens, and we'll live with it. But you know what's going to happen today?
Ooh, what's that?
On today's show, we're going to answer some questions about beauty products. Specifically, is my cellar water as great as it's made out to be? How does John Frieda's lightning shampoo work, and is it a permanent color change? Is it okay to add lactic acid to a moisturizer? Where do you find studies on how ingredients perform? And are hair straighteners still using formaldehyde or formaldehyde donors? Ah, Valerie.
Very interesting. Good show.
Yeah, and of course, we're going to do a couple of beauty science news. But I did want to say that last week was my big online trade show called Teamworks here in the Midwest. And it went all right. It was a bit of a challenge.
Everything was good?
You know, we had 8 hours of content about cosmetic raw materials. Ooh, really thrilling stuff. But it did give me
very
a chance
exciting.
To... Yes, it gave me a chance to... you know, learn about preservatives and thickeners and the latest technologies there. Also gave me a chance to juggle and play the ukulele in front of an audience of over 3,000 people.
Oh, God. Of course you did that.
Incidentally, the replay will be up. So if anybody in the Beauty Brains audience is interested in such things, I'll provide a link in the show notes of where you can see that replay, at least for the next 2 weeks.
Well, very exciting for our listeners who are interested in learning more about what we do.
Or just seeing some ukulele playing, which aren't many. All right, shall we move on to the beauty science news?
Yeah. I read an article this week that I thought was very interesting. Two University of Maine students discovered a protein derived from lobster could calm the dry itch flare-up of eczema, according to an article in MaineBiz.com. That's not a scientific publication, but I guess there was an article there. So two students were researching lobsters, and they hypothesized that this protein they found hydrate the skin. One of the researchers suffers from eczema, and she decided to do a patch test to check the glycoprotein's effects.
All right.
In just a few days, her eczema started to clear. Wowee.
Wow, that's amazing.
Since then, the pair have formulated a cream for retail that combines the glycoprotein they found with other skin hydrating and protecting ingredients, including hyaluronic acid, squalane, shea butter, coconut oil, and vitamin E. The product helps to build the skin's barrier while hydrating and minimizing skin moisture loss. And I pretty much just read out of an article in Cosmetics and Toiletries, which is where this was found. But I went on a bit of a Twitter rampage about this because what a compelling, beautiful story. But I feel like there's some flaws or at least some things that were not discussed. So, okay, very small study group. N equals one.
Right.
One
so it doesn't get much
eczema.
Smaller than doesn't get
they
much smaller
found this
than
random,
that.
Yeah, glycoprotein. And we're like, hey, you know what? Maybe this will cure my eczema. And they just put it on their own skin without any other safety studies.
Well,
I mean, who does that?
Well, at least they didn't just take a whole lobster and rub the lobster on the back of their skin.
That'd be awkward. I mean, for me, when there is an ingredient, it's very important important that basic safety studies are conducted, especially when it comes to proteins and the skin. Several proteins can cause allergic reactions, and I would want to know where their allergy studies were. And actually, someone on Twitter had put that at me, like, hey, did they evaluate this for potential allergenicity before they popped it into this cream? And this one individual even said that the spike protein in SARS-CoV-2 is a glycoprotein and a target of most of the vaccine. So that's a case where there is this glycoprotein and it's not safe. You know, COVID, not safe.
Yeah.
Right. Just because this glycoprotein is found in a lobster doesn't mean that it's safe for use. The other piece that I have an issue with, that if this really did cure eczema, this product would not be a cosmetic. It would be considered a drug. And I think with such a small group, one person's experience, no safety studies that I'm aware of, I just think it's a little premature to pop this in a cream and then tout that it cures eczema, because that would be a drug claim.
Absolutely.
And last time I checked, this lobster glycoprotein is not an approved active for treating eczema symptoms. So just my little rant for the week. I hate, great story, but I just hate when people, you know, have this, like, we'll call it a rags to riches story. It's like, come on.
Yeah.
This is why cosmetics aren't safe.
There were a couple of things that struck me too. First, the source, it was Cosmetics and Toiletries magazine, which the target is for cosmetic scientists. And of course, cosmetic scientists are going to look at that and say, hey, that's not research. I mean, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that struck me is that you talked about all the other ingredients that they put in there, squalane, the shea butter, and for moisturizing. And then the
emollient. Ooh, right. Yeah.
But the first thing that occurs to me is, like, if you're trying to make a good product, why wouldn't you use petrolatum first? I mean, that's an ingredient that's proven to work to be the best. I don't know. It just seems like they didn't really know a lot about formulating, and then they just went off and said, oh, we made a drug. So it's maybe it's cosmetic formulating snobbery on my part. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I mean, just a lot of things rub us the wrong way. And the other piece is, with how vegan skincare is trending, you know, I don't know that people are going to want this lobster product in their skincare, especially I'm not sure how this glycoprotein is harvested from the lobsters.
Right.
You know, it's from their circulatory system. So are they having, you know, how are they getting it?
I imagine a bunch of gurneys with a little IV coming out of the lobster's arm, and they're just taking some plasma or something. Is that
out of the lobster claw?
Right. A little something like that.
Aww.
No. I mean, how do you come out with a product like this in the world of vegan cosmetics, or even how do you get away around, like, no animal testing? Because you're certainly going to have to test on animals here, right?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Especially for some of the safety studies, you just can't get around it. Yeah.
Exactly. It's befuddling.
What did you see this week?
I saw, you know, I continued to follow these customized beauty and device makers. And here is a story about a new skin analysis tool that claims to improve the ability for people to customize skincare. It seems this tech firm, Perfect Corp, out of Thailand, has come up with this new artificial intelligence that is supposed to be able to analyze your skin and help companies to provide you with customized skin products. Apparently, they are working with Neutrogena to develop the Skin 360 app. And also, they have this UCam technology, which is an app that lets you manipulate the image that you get from your webcam in real time. Kind of like this webcam thing that I have, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm all green screen. Anyway, they have this new generation of AI skin diagnostic, which is meant to power devices that analyze your skin. Using over 70,000 clinical images, the company's tool measures 8 metrics of skin health, such as the level of oiliness, your wrinkle depth, the types of wrinkles, your skin texture, and dark circles, that sort of stuff. Then they say, using that data, the brands will theoretically be able to customize products to your skin type. Now, while this is really interesting technology, I love the AI stuff and it sounds pretty cool, And it's likely that the AI could even tell you whether you have oily skin or how oily your skin is or how wrinkly it is or whatever mm-hmm. measure they're talking about. I believe they can do this. I'm just not sure this information is terribly useful. You know what I mean? Like the science of cosmetic formulating, I don't think is so advanced that you could take advantage of this knowledge. I mean, it's kind of the same problem I have with the companies that supposedly analyze your DNA and then give you some sort of customized skincare. Even if we knew how you scored on, say, X amount of oiliness, like how would you even formulate a product differently? Mm-hmm. So if somebody rates a 10 on oiliness and somebody rates a 7 on oiliness, like what would you do different? I mean, maybe you'd reduce the level of some emollient in there or your occlusive agent, but it's not going to be at a level where people would even notice. I don't know. It's just, it kind of reminds me of even hair care, right? We always tried to segment hair by volumizing and normal. Mm-hmm. And what was the other one? Extra body, normal. And then the thin kind of
thicken hair or something like
right.
that.
Exactly. Anyway, marketers try to segment this stuff. And, you know, the reality is the difference between a normal and an extra body shampoo, at least the way we formulated, was that you just like took out 2% surfactant. And so it cleaned your hair a little less for the volumizing one or something. Nobody could really tell a difference. And that's what I think about these types of customized skin technologies. It's all just kind of smoke and mirrors, right? And while they may be able to differentiate formulas from, say, oily skin to not oily, you know, and we can barely do that, you just can't differentiate products from, say, really oily skin to normally oily skin. And it's not to mention the fact that consumers also have texture preferences. So no matter how well a product works for them, it's like, how does it feel on my skin, right? And you formulate to when people are using it and how that experience is, not necessarily the end result that they're going to get 2 weeks later. Anyway, my advice is you shouldn't fall for these customized beauty product routines. You know, no matter how much AI they develop or how many of these portable devices get launched, formulating the science of it is just not advanced enough where products can take advantage of this information. All right, end Perry rant. Are we ready to go on to some beauty questions?
Yeah. What's our first question?
First question comes to us from a person who wanted to talk specifically to you, Valerie.
Hello, Valerie. Hello, Perry. This is Elizabeth from Minneapolis. Valerie, a few episodes ago, you had mentioned that you were not a fan of micellar water, and I was just curious if that was due to a personal preference or if micellar water is not as great a product as it's made out to be. Just wondering. Thank you.
Micellar water. Valerie, I didn't know you were a fan.
I'm not a fan. I've mentioned it a couple times, and here's why I don't like micellar water. I'm not a fan of anything that uses surfactants that typically would be rinsed off. I'm not a fan of leaving those on the skin. Typically with these micellar waters or micellar cleansers, you take a cotton pad, you soak it, you wipe your skin to remove the makeup, and then there's no need to rinse. And there's barely any surfactant in these products. Surfactants are, you know, the detergents or the cleansing agents. It's very, very low level. And typically there's other humectants in there or actives that, you know, deliver some really good skin feel while this, you know, surfactant is wiping over the skin. And in general, I don't like to use leave-on products that contain these cleansing agents in them because I find that they can be irritating to skin. They're irritating to my skin. Some of the companies use desyl glucoside,
right,
which is a, we'll call it a quote unquote sugar based surfactant, which can be an irritant to skin. Some of these companies are using other surfactants, and I don't like them. I don't like leaving it on the skin. I think surfactants are meant to be rinsed, and For me, I would just rather splash water on my face. I think that's about as effective as micellar water is.
I would agree. Or at
And
least if you
then,
took
or even just
a
like,
cotton ball, a wet cotton ball or something.
yeah. So for me, why just put those ingredients on my skin and leave them on? I'm someone who has sensitive skin. I have rosacea, so that's my perspective. If it's working out great for you and you really enjoy them, that's fantastic. But for me, it's a personal preference, and I think maybe some other people may also experience irritation, and they may not realize it's detergents or surfactants from the micellar water, or even, when they have botanical extracts in there. I'm just not a big fan of leaving that stuff on your skin.
Right, it's a personal preference, but there's some valid science behind the idea that it could be irritating, especially leaving, surfactants on your skin,
Yeah.
especially cleansing ones, can be that. And even those glucosides, wasn't that the allergen of the year a couple of years ago, a
It
desoglucoside?
was,
Yeah, so.
which is why I mentioned them. Yeah. So I put the val in validity. I'm just kidding. But no, it's really just personal preference. But there's some scientific foundation to it. It's not just, a texture thing. I just, I have sensitive skin, and I'd rather rinse everything off.
Wait, you have that on your business card, don't you?
Oh gosh. Elizabeth, great question though. Thanks. And we enjoy the discourse and the questions from our listeners, challenging our thoughts.
All right, next one is a challenging one. This one comes to us from Jonathan, ironically. It says, are the effects from John Frieda Lightning Shampoo and Conditioner permanent? It claims to make you 2 shades lighter, and that would be great, but is this a permanent effect? I thought this was a very interesting question, and my gut reaction to this is that no, of course, these hair lightening shampoos and conditioners don't work because the only thing that's going to lighten your hair pretty much is bleach. And there's not going to be enough contact time and enough concentration that it's going to discolor your hair. So, no, they don't work. But then I took a look at the system, and not to my surprise, there is no bleach in the shampoo and conditioner of these products, the John Frieda lightening shampoo or conditioner. And so, of course, then you say to yourself, well, okay, there's no bleach there. But then if you look at the claims, this turns out to be one of those claims gimmicks that companies actually do pretty frequently. If you look at the claims specifically, they say that your hair gets lighter when you use the shampoo plus the conditioner plus the spray. And then
Yep,
if you
very
look,
important to look at the fine print. Yep.
exactly. And then if you look at that spray, well, the second ingredient is bleach. So, of
Well,
course,
hydrogen
yeah.
peroxide,
I'm sorry,
which
hydrogen
bleaches
peroxide.
the
You're
hair. Yep,
right. I'm
yep.
sorry. You're right. It's not.
I'm a
It's
hair
actually.
color chemist. The nuances are important here.
You are correct. Hydrogen peroxide, the second ingredient here. And so the reality is that shampoo and conditioner you use before using this spray, it doesn't really matter. They're just good shampoos and conditioners, sure, but you could use anybody's. And the lightening shampoos and conditioners, they get to say that on those products because it's part of the system. But those products by themselves are not going to lighten your hair. This is actually a common tactic that beauty product brands use, especially in the hair care area. They try to sell you this system, and then they make claims about that whole system. I know Pantene does that all the time. But yeah, this is really common with hair care brands. But although that Proactiv brand, they did it too, where they sell you the anti-acne kit. But the reality is only one of the products there is actually the anti-acne product. So this is just a strategy that cosmetic marketers use, and it gets you to buy more products. The reality is that in almost all of these system products, you get the main benefit from just one product, and then the other ones are just kind of standard products that kind of help to support the story, but they don't actually provide much extra benefit.
Yeah, if they had just said, oh, well, it's a spray that does the lightening, you'd be like, well, why do I need your shampoo and conditioner, right? So it looks a little more compelling to have this system set up. The other piece is the shampoo and conditioner, they do have colorant in them, which helps support the brighter, blonder claim. It is yellow colorant, so it makes your blondes appear blonder, which is like more yellow, which I don't know if that's a desired characteristic, but they do have that in the shampoo and conditioner as well. So yeah, very interesting line. I do recommend to stay away from these product types that have hydrogen peroxide. So in this case, I would just stay away from the spray because hydrogen peroxide is very damaging to hair, especially when just left on the hair. You should never just leave hydrogen peroxide on the hair. Not only does it lighten your hair color, it really damages the hair fibers. So I do not recommend any, I don't recommend hydrogen peroxide period unless you're just coloring your hair, and it should always be rinsed off. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
I would say that just the one other piece of this, the question was, is this a permanent effect? And from the shampoo and conditioner, no, it's not a permanent effect. But when you put the hydrogen peroxide on your hair, yeah, that's a permanent effect.
Mm-hmm.
So, permanent color change and permanent hair damage too. So there you go.
Yep.
Well, what's our next question? Look at us, Val. We've got another audio question.
What?
This is someone who wants to be a cosmetic chemist, I guess.
Hi, Beauty Brains from Vancouver, Canada. I have a question with regards to amlactin. It's a popular product available at Costco, but of course it's not available in Canada. And with the shutdown, we're not able to get it. I was thinking about purchasing the CeraVe moisturizing lotion and adding in some lactic acid and mixing it up on my own. Is that something that I can sort of mix up in bulk, or is it best to mix up per use? As well, I also wanted to plug Perry's book, which is one of my faves. Can you Get Hooked on Lip Balm? Of course, available on Amazon, and I'm going back and rereading it right now. It's a great book, and I highly recommend it to all of the podcast listeners out there. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Uh-oh. Perry, you chose this question because they plugged your book.
Well, I didn't even... How did that even get in there?
I wish you guys could have seen Perry's grin. He was like, ooh-hoo.
I don't even know how that got in there.
Well, Perry, before we answer the question, which is a great question, because by the way, I've used this lotion. How can people get your book?
Well, that book, I think, is they can get it on Amazon.
They can still get it?
Yeah, I think so. You can still get it. Yeah.
Great. All right. Yeah, we get that question a lot. So yeah. Check out Amazon. So amlactin, I have a funny story about this product. I bought some because one of my coworkers was raving about how soft it made her skin feel. I bought it on Amazon. You can get it there yourself if you're so inclined. And I put it on my body. I was working from home and all day I kept smelling ammonia. And believe it or not, I don't usually check ingredients before I put a product on my skin.
What?
Look at the claims. And if I'm super interested, I'll
look. You don't do the patch testing thing or anything?
Nah, I just use it. And usually I actually use it and then I look. I try to guess what I think is in it. It's like a little game, especially with hair care.
Wait a second. Valerie, just one little break here. Let me ask you this. If you were eating lobster and you had a little patch on your skin, would you put that lobster on the back of your hand or anything?
No. Okay. I also don't like lobster. I'm one of like five people in America who don't like it, I think.
Well, it wasn't always a delicatessen that it is. A delicatessen? I'm sorry, it wasn't always a delicacy that it is right now.
Yeah. Okay.
Where were we? So, oh, yeah, you were talking about how you smelled like ammonia all day.
Yeah, so I was like, oh my gosh, where is this ammonia coming from? I was looking all over my house. I was like, did my dumb self like bring a hair tube home and it broke open, or is something leaking? I was looking everywhere and then I realized the ammonia smell was coming from me. And that is because this company who makes amlactin, they don't actually put lactic acid in the formula. They put ammonium lactate. And when product hits your skin, ammonium lactate converts to ammonia and lactic acid, which is how they can get away with creating this formulation. If they just put 12% lactic acid into the formulation, the pH would be so low, they would have to add sodium hydroxide or something to raise the pH up. It just wouldn't work. So how they can get 12% lactic acid is by using ammonium lactate, and then it releases lactic acid for the skin and ammonia. And lactic acid actually is very softening to the skin.
Yeah.
But I think the mineral oil and glycerin help in this formula. as well. But anyway, just my funny story. I literally was running around for like 2 hours. Like, where is this hair color tube?
Well, that's interesting. And it's interesting that that's the technology that the amlactin people are using.
It's such an old basic technology. It's interesting.
So what about putting lactic acid in the finished CeraVe product?
I just, you know, I'm not sure that's a good idea for a couple reasons. And, you know, maybe you can help add some other reasons as well. The first is lactic acid can lower the pH of your CeraVe formulation. And even if you're using it immediately, unless you have a pH meter, that can be pretty dangerous, especially if you get down below 3, below 2, which you can get by adding just a little bit of lactic acid to something. If the CeraVe is not meant to be formulated at that low of a pH and you're adding this lactic acid and it's not getting buffered, it can easily cause harm to your skin.
Yeah, so there's not it's not obvious that you should just put that much, and certainly not 12%.
No. And that's using it fresh. I also wouldn't make it and store it for the same reason that when you formulate a cream, you already have like your end pH in mind. You have your actives in mind, and you build the cream around knowing, okay, once lactic acid is liberated, I need 12% lactic acid. And by just pumping a bunch in there, even if you get to a fine pH, we don't know that the formula is stable with that. So
yeah, that's...
Do you want to talk stability testing?
No, that's definitely a problem. And if we were formulating something like this and we wanted to test to make sure that it was going to be safe, you would actually put the ingredients in there and then you would run a stability test over months just to make sure that it doesn't chemically break down, grow bacteria, or, you know, discolor or change odor or any of those kinds of things. When you're doing this yourself, if you're going to do it, and we don't recommend that you do it, but if you are going to do it, I mean, I suppose putting in a percent or so of lactic acid in there probably is not going to be too harmful. Although you should test the pH of it for sure.
Yeah, but, get some pH strips. Yeah.
But if you are going to do it, definitely don't do it on a big bottle, but just do it on the portion that you're going to use right away, because over time, that's probably going to break down.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question.
Magali says, hello, I'm a big fan of your podcast.
Yay.
I always hear you talk about laboratory studies that you search for to find out if ingredients will work or not. Can you please tell me where I can look for them? I'm a chemist student in Paraguay, and you're my favorite teacher. Well, thanks.
Do you think they were talking about you or me?
I think they're talking about me. Oh. Do you think they're talking about you?
I think they're talking about the plural vous. It's just in English, we don't have that pluralized you in the same way they do, say, in French or something.
No, I think they're talking about me.
Yeah, probably. Because they like their teacher to smell like ammonia. Okay.
Yeah. Well, Perry, where do we find out about all of our good stuff?
Well, I'm going to give you some secrets. We'll share secrets. I'll give you mine. You give them yours. All and right. We'll see where we end up. The reality is that there are over 22,000 ingredients that a cosmetic chemist could use in cosmetics, as listed in the INCI dictionary. Yeah. So you can't possibly memorize what every ingredient does. I mean, I've tried, but you can't. I just couldn't come up with the mnemonic device to do that. So what, and you also can't keep up with all of the latest studies on everything. So you have to make Google Scholar or PubMed your friend. So usually when someone asks me about an ingredient, even if it's an ingredient I know something about, popular ones, hyaluronic acids, vitamin C, retinol, those sorts of things that I've looked at a lot, I will still go to Google Scholar and I will look up the ingredient. And then I would also put in the words review and topical. So if I wanted to find out what's the latest on vitamin C and its effect on skin, I'd go vitamin C, topical review. And that's going to list publications in peer-reviewed journals that are going to review the all of the studies that have been done on that particular ingredient. So that those are so PubMed and Google Scholar are probably my main go-tos.
And just so you guys know, he's not talking about University of Google, like some elusive thing that doesn't really exist, that's snarky. Google Scholar is actually a website within Google. I think it's google.scholar.com or scholar.google.com.
Yeah, that's it.
That they actually say, okay, take all the other stuff from the internet out, search these publications for papers. You can also pull up patents as well or exclude patents. You can define what years you want to do the research at. Maybe list authors. It's a pretty cool search tool. That's one of my favorites to do as well.
Yeah, it's
I also like to look.
It's not the general Google search. So if you go to Google and search, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about Google Scholar specifically.
Yes. I personally like to look through publications myself. I do use Google Scholar. Of course, I look at the Journal of Society of Cosmetic Chemists. I have like every hair paper downloaded, the International Journal. The International Journal of Cosmetic Science, which is like all of the Society of Cosmetic Chemists in the world, can submit to these publications. There's also JAMA, and they have different publications within there. And oftentimes there is a paper search engine that I use that looks at lots of journals and it aggregates them all together. And most of the time I can't get access to the papers. It's a private service I pay for. Yeah. Personally, and I'll look through papers from there as well. But I guess the trend is we're looking at scientific organizations, researchers, you know, legit people. We're just not, you know, going to, you know, glamour.com and being right. Like, hey, what about vitamin C?
Or randomblogger.com. Yeah.
Yeah. We're actually looking through and digging through the science, and we're using Google Scholar. We're using scientific paper search engines. And another great place I like to look at are at the safety assessments that are done for ingredients, whether it's the Cosmetic Ingredient Review doing them or the SCCS in Europe. I like to look through those because sometimes you can get really good background data, of course, toxicology data, and then references as well.
And with these review papers, so these searches will often result in review papers. Then you have to go that extra step of looking at the papers that are cited in the review and then review that specific study. Because a review paper doesn't actually do any kind of study. It just reports on all the studies in the field that have been done. And only in that way can you get specific questions answered about ingredients and their effectiveness.
Sometimes we go down like a big rabbit hole. I know I talk about Frank a lot. If you guys remember, Frank is the gentleman who wrote a question about an eye cream that contained caffeine.
That's right.
And I literally spent months reading about topical caffeine application, its effect on sleep rhythms. And by the time we got to answering his question, Perry was like, hey, we got to answer this question. The cream had been discontinued. And it's not because we just didn't get to it. You know, you get to read papers, and then you look at who they were citing, and then you read those papers, and it can become this black hole. And sometimes you just have to know when to cut it off. And apparently, I didn't know when that was. So again, Frank, I'm very sorry that you know your caffeine eye cream is not available anymore.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, it looks like we have time for one more question. Another audio question. Look at us knocking out three audio questions.
Woo.
Hi, Beauty Brains. I am Ines, a Spanish dermatologist and member of a team of five dermatologists and scientific writers called Dermotech. And we thought of you because we just came across with a new article from the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatologists that found a relationship between hair straightening with formalin and frontal fibrosing alopecia, which is a type of alopecia that we are seeing more and more every day in our clinics, and at present it doesn't have an effective treatment. So we know that formalin is nowadays forbidden in hair straightening products, but as you already know, some formaldehyde releases like quaternium 15, DMDM, hydantoin, among others, are widely used as preservatives in cleansers, moisturizers, sunscreens, and hair care products. So we have two questions for you. Are hair straightening treatments using formaldehyde releases instead of formaldehyde nowadays? And could these releases have the same effect as formaldehyde? Thank you so much. We are big fans of your show.
Well, that was an interesting question.
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting.
So formaldehyde straighteners, these are the Brazilian hair straighteners, which were all the rage up until about 2012 when people started saying, hey, wait, there's formaldehyde in those, like high levels of formaldehyde. And that's how that system worked. I think you can still get Brazilian hair straightening done, but I don't think it's nearly as prevalent out there, right?
No, it definitely has had a negative reputation. And then I think what also helped is that waves, curls, beachier textures are coming into fashion and not so much the sleek, slim hair that was so prevalent in the early 2000s when these Brazilian straighteners were all the rage. So I think part of it has to do with negative press. A lot of it has to do with negative press, and rightly so.
Yeah.
And the second piece is just how people are wearing their hair.
Well, the way that these things worked, the idea is that hair is composed of keratin protein, and then you take a keratin treatment, you put it on there, and then you use formaldehyde. Formaldehyde with a little bit of heat will actually chemically react with hair protein, and that can have the effect of cross-linking the hair, or it can have the protein bonds in the hair, it can cross-link those and make the hair less kinky. And it can also have the effect of chemically bonding the keratin to the hair also. And so, actually, you know, I did some work with formaldehyde in hair back when I was working on a thing called a color lock treatment for Tresemme, because it turns out one way that you can keep hair locked into color, or color locked into hair for longer, is that you just treat it with some a spray of formaldehyde. It just turns out to last longer. And that was kind of what our theory of how it worked. It would it causes more cross-linking bonds within the hair fiber, and then it makes the color harder for it to leak out even when you get it wet. Ultimately, that did turn into a patent for me, and Tresemme actually launched it. That was my one of my only two.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, it was
very cool.
The way I discovered it was completely by accident. And it had to do with me not wanting to wash 100 hair tresses. So I decided to just soak them in water instead. And the water started to smell bad. So I put formaldehyde or DMDM hydantoin in there, actually. And then the color didn't come out of the hair tress anymore. So
totally. An accidental discovery.
Totally an accident. So
from
anyway.
Laziness. I'm just kidding. Color well, safe testing, by the way, is like so time consuming. So I totally get it.
Oh, we'd have to do like 100, wash 100 tresses by simulating 6 weeks of, you know, color. I'm like, wait, that's like,
it's like
one
the worst.
Dress. Yeah, it took forever. So anyway, these straighteners actually don't break down the hair bonds like a relaxer would. So they're not as damaging. But what they do instead is they essentially will add bonds. That's the theory anyway. So what happens is you straighten the hair and then you cause bonding between the strands of the protein. And then you cause bonding with the extra additional keratin that'll stay on there. And it'll stay straight for a while. I was never terribly impressed with how effective these treatments were. And it was always amusing to me that the advice that the salon would give you is that, oh, you know, just don't wash your hair as much. And I'm like, yeah, because you'll wash out the straightening. So
yeah,
this kind of straightening was not a permanent hair straightening like, say, a relaxer is. A relaxer, once you straighten it, it's not going to unstraighten. But as far as this goes now, like we said, these treatments aren't done nearly as often, but if they are done, if they work, it's going to require some sort of formaldehyde, and a formaldehyde donor can work. To give you an idea, if you were using straight formalin, I think that's about a 37% formaldehyde release, whereas DMDM hydantoin is going to release
it's very small.
Yeah, like 0.05%. So you need to use a lot more. But so I think basically if you're not using formaldehyde or what some people try to call methylene chloride, or is that what it is? Methylene chloride?
Methylene glycol.
Yeah, methylene glycol. That's it, right? Methylene glycol, which is just formaldehyde in water. If you're not using that, then these products pretty much are going to be super temporary. You can straighten the hair, you put the protein film on your hair, and as long as you don't wash it off, it'll keep it straight. But, you know, two washes and it'll be gone.
Yeah, I mean, people, it's not possible to use enough of a preservative to get enough formaldehyde to straighten the hair like the previous Brazilian blowouts were working. It's just not possible. You could use 100% DMDM hydantoin and you're not going to get enough formaldehyde to work. And certainly you're not allowed to use that much. It's very restricted in terms of use level.
Yeah,
there's just no way that you're going to get that much. So I think anyone using formaldehyde type chemistry, even, you know, if they're technically not using formalin or methylene glycol, I just can't think of anything that they would be using that's contributing enough formaldehyde to work in that way. So I hope that answers the question. You know, Perry, I used to be a big user of these Brazilian blowout treatments.
Oh, did you?
And a big user, I mean, I had it done like three times. But
yeah. How'd they work for you?
I'm going to be honest. I really loved them.
Oh, yeah.
I'm probably going to get cancer from them.
No. I would also say, just on that, because that is a concern that people have. The people who have to worry about cancer from them are these stylists who had to put this stuff on because they're smelling the fumes. If done right, it doesn't get to the user, you know, the person who gets it done on their hair. So,
well, it can. It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't have adequate ventilation, and a lot of salons don't. And my skin used to peel because when you use it, you have to like paint the hair with a solution and then you have to blow dry it into the hair.
Right.
And then you have to flat iron it into the hair. And some of the vapors are hitting your skin. Some of the solution's hitting your skin invariably. And for about a week, I knew that I could never go see my boyfriend at the time because my scalp was just crusting and peeling in like huge flakes.
Oh, my.
And I was like, but it's so worth it. My hair was so straight, so sleek. I have hair that looks like male leg hair, except it's like 18 inches long. For me to get these treatments was really, I don't want to call it life-saving, but really life-transforming in that I didn't have to worry about doing my hair because it could air dry and look perfect like I'd just gotten a blowout. So I totally understand the appeal. I also understand that those initial formulas were incredibly unsafe. Thankfully, there is regulation worldwide that it's not okay to put formaldehyde in there or these you know, it needs to be limited to a point that makes it not usable as a straightener anymore.
Right.
And formaldehyde is regulated at, I think, 2,000 parts per million as a preservative, at least in the EU. And if you ate a pear, you eat about 60 parts per million of formaldehyde. So if you're really worried about formaldehyde, you'd stop eating fruits.
Now, let me ask you this, Valerie. In California, do you have to put the Prop 65 label on a pear when you buy it?
Yeah, it's like this pear can cause cancer. And anyway, it's so silly. I totally get, you know, the Brazilian straightener stuff. People you have to worry about formaldehyde donors, which are preservatives like DMDM hydantoin, causing any issues because you couldn't use enough to have any straightening activity. So it's just likely to be a moot point in there.
I did have one more question. When you did the Brazilian straightening, did it make you look more like Kate Ferguson or who was that royal?
Kate Middleton, come on.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well,
I can't keep up with all these royals.
I feel like I look more like her. Yeah. Just because I have, but you know, my hair didn't hold curl well. It just like, I just kind of had to wear it straight every day. So, well, I don't get them anymore.
Well, that's probably a good thing. And just a final thing on that. If people do experience hair loss, from this, everything that I read on it was that it would probably be a temporary thing.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, I think it depends. But for the most part, it should grow back.
All right. Well, that brings us to the top of the hour and the end of the show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
If you get a chance, please go over to iTunes and leave us a review. That will help other people find the show and ensure we have a full docket of beauty questions to answer.
And if you have any questions that you want to submit and maybe get your voice on the Beauty Brain Show, just record it on your smartphone and email it to thebeautybrains@gmail.com.
Also, don't forget to follow us on our various social media accounts. On Instagram, we're at TheBeautyBrains2018. On Twitter, we're at TheBeautyBrains. And we have a Facebook page.
Plus, we're also on Patreon. And thank you so much to all of our patrons. You can follow us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/TheBeautyBrains and subscribe. And in November, we're going to have another live Patreon event. Or patrons only. Probably in a couple of weeks, we'll send you an email on that.
Well, thanks again for listening, everyone. And remember, be brainy about your beauty.
Thanks, everyone.
Kittens. Kitty, cat, 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 cat. Kitty, cat, 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 cat. Kitty, cat, 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 cat. Kitty, cat, 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 cat.